Welcome to Urban Dharma, the podcast, where suffering is optional. Hi, this is Reverend Kusala coming to you from downtown Los Angeles, from the International Buddhist Meditation Center. It's Sunday afternoon. It's actually comfortable today. It's supposed to be in the high 70s, low 80s. So what a change of pace this is. Well, the podcast you're about to hear is an interview I did with my friend Reverend Nori Ito, who is a Buddhist priest at a Japanese Pure Land temple in downtown Los Angeles. And we had a wonderful interview. I just got through listening to it again, and we covered a lot of territory. We talked about how he moved to America in the early 50s, how he didn't know if he wanted to be a priest or not, even though his father and grandfather had been priests in Japanese temples. His school years, his ordination, his work with the Buddhist Catholic Dialogue, starting the Buddhist Club at Occidental College, and last but not least, taking students from his temple to Hiroshima and Nagasaki to introduce them to the horrors of nuclear war. So again, we covered a lot of information. This particular podcast is about an hour and 18 minutes long. So set some time aside and listen, if you'd like, to my interview with Reverend Nori Ito about being a Buddhist priest in Los Angeles. This is Wednesday. It's a little bit after 3 o'clock, and I'm in downtown Los Angeles on 3rd Street, and I'm in a Japanese Buddhist temple, and I'm going to ask Reverend Nori Ito to pronounce it for me.
Higashi Honganji Buddhist Temple.
Oh, thank you. Reverend Ito and I met years ago. We're both involved with Buddhist clubs. I'm at UCLA, and Reverend Ito's at Occidental College. We're also both part of the Buddhist Catholic Dialogue in Los Angeles. So we've come together many times, and I asked him if he wouldn't mind doing an interview, and he said, I wouldn't mind. So I'm here today, and I'd like to start. My first question would be, were you born a Buddhist, or did you come to Buddhism later in life?
Well, first of all, I'd like to clarify that. I wouldn't mind. I said I'd be honored.
Oh, okay.
But, yes, thank you.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
I was born a Buddhist. My father was a priest, and my grandfather, on both sides, they were both priests. So I come from a long line of Buddhist priests.
Okay. And for people listening, the word priest and monk are different. Priests in the Japanese tradition are allowed to be married and have children and a wife. And you're married and have three children?
Yes.
Three children, okay. Were you born in Japan or were you born in America?
I was born in Japan.
Okay, and when did you come to America?
I came with my family. My father was assigned to the temple in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
He was assigned in 53.
1953.
And the rest of the family, we stayed in Japan for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And he realized that he couldn't go back to Japan right away, and so he called for us. And we came in 55. I was almost 7 at the time.
Okay. And was he happy about coming to America?
He really wasn't.
Okay.
To be honest, because we, in our tradition, Jodo Shinshu tradition, we have we've had a married clergy ever since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So about 800 years of married clergy.
Okay.
And he was the second son of his temple, so therefore he wouldn't take over, the temple of his birth. But for second and third sons, oftentimes what happens is they marry into another temple that doesn't have a son, or maybe work at our headquarters, as a staff priest or something like that. And so he was working for a long time for our mother temple in Kyoto, and being transferred to different areas, serving at different temples. But he happened to meet my mother's brother. And my mother, well, it's a kind of a strange situation where she was born into a temple with a lot of brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. but she had an aunt and uncle who had no children. And so she was promised to them because she was like the second daughter.
I see.
Fourth down, you know, from among all of the children.
Okay.
And so she was promised to my aunt and uncle's temple, or her aunt and uncle's temple.
Okay.
And so she grew up there. But being that there was no son, eventually she was going to be asked to marry someone who would come in and take over the temple.
Mm.
And so her older brother happened to be a friend of my father. They were introduced, and he became the head priest of that temple.
Mm-hmm.
And it was around that time that his father or father-in-law was still healthy. And so he was serving down in the Kyushu area, way down south, and then also served up in Hokkaido, way up, you know, the northernmost island.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the administrators of the Mother Temple came to see him one day and said, "We have a problem. The priest at our temple in Los Angeles is getting set to come return to Japan, and we need someone to replace him. And so, will you go?" And he actually said that he's not the right person because he can't speak a word of English. His English teacher at Otani University was D.T. Suzuki's wife,
wow.
Beatrice Suzuki.
Yeah.
And he said that he was the worst student. And so he wouldn't be of any use in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Plus, he had been adopted into his wife's temple, and that he had the responsibility to take over that temple after his father-in-law retired.
Mm-hmm.
And so he can't go to Los Angeles. Well, so then they took no for an answer the first time, but they came back a few months later and said, "We really need you to go. Can you just go for 1 or 2 years?" And so he accepted the appointment, came over by himself.
Mm-hmm.
And once he got here and got to meet the members of the temple and to see the situation for himself, he realized that he couldn't return right away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he called us 2 years later to join him.
So he sensed a great need for
yes.
his services here.
Right.
And he may have liked Los Angeles once he got here anyway.
I think so. With the weather.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And then I think that the other thing was, this was back in the 50s.
Yes.
When the Japanese communities were still, kind of intact and, very vibrant,
mm-hmm.
and the first generation were still in control mm-hmm. of the community and of the temples,
mm-hmm.
and so you really didn't need to speak good English to get by.
So he was probably living in a Japanese neighborhood.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Businesses
yes.
he frequented
yes.
spoke Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
okay. So he pretty much served his whole career without really speaking English.
I mean, without having to speak English.
Right.
Huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So when you came over, then you, I imagine, learned English. It would
yes,
probably be a lot easier because you were young.
Yeah.
And you were in pretty much the Japanese culture, I would imagine, within
yes.
the L.A. culture.
Right.
Okay.
It was a kind of getting used to, being in an English-speaking community.
Yeah.
Well, in an English-speaking country,
uh-huh.
but where Japanese was, spoken,
okay.
At least at the temple and,
mm-hmm.
At home and
mm-hmm.
so forth. And so I started first grade, in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Went through high school.
So in
Boyle Heights, East Los Angeles.
Oh. Okay, so you were reading and writing English right from the get-go,
right.
as they say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing is, I think my father realized that after maybe 4 or 5 years and, the children getting used to life here and learning English quickly and kind of starting to put aside, our native language,
mm-hmm.
And the culture and so forth,
mm-hmm.
that he realized that if we were in Japan, then I would automatically have been chosen to take over after my father
mm.
at the family temple. But in the United States, the temples aren't run, you know, in the traditional way. And so when a minister or a priest retires or passes away, then a new one is, found mm-hmm. and put into place. And so it's not a automatic succession from father to son.
I see.
And he realized that I was just, you know, quickly becoming American and mm-hmm. just kind of, didn't express any real interest in the temple, you know, mm-hmm. other than having to be there all the time. Mm-hmm. I think he made the conscious choice not to force it, mm-hmm. and not even to mention it. And you know, I came over at such a young age that I didn't know the Japanese system.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I just figured, well, he's giving me the freedom to, you know, be who I am, to be who I wanted to be, and to pursue whatever, you know, ambitions, dreams I had. Mm-hmm. So he never mentioned, as I was growing up, that he would like me to consider, you know, the priesthood.
I see.
You know, coming into the temple. And so Japanese also, the language, you know, my parents sent me to, we had Japanese language schools back in those days. And it was, you know, right in our neighborhood.
So you would go to school, learn English.
Yes.
And then you go to Japanese
right.
school to learn Japanese.
Yeah. Nowadays it's only on Saturdays.
I see.
But back in the 50s, it was every day.
Wow.
And so we'd go to public school till 3 o'clock. And then maybe at 4 o'clock for another couple of hours, hour and a half or so, we'd be in Japanese school.
Mm.
And I hated it. I couldn't stand it. And all I could think of was, how am I going to get out of this?
Yeah.
Because many of my friends didn't have that, you know, didn't have that obligation. And
sure.
So I only took 2 years of Japanese school, and okay. I was able to find a way out. And by the time I was in high school, my parents really still hadn't learned how to speak English, you know, fluently. And so I would talk to them in English, they would respond in Japanese, and that's how we were able to maintain a conversation.
Wow. Now, growing up in L.A. in the 50s as a Buddhist, did you feel any sense of prejudice or confusion? Because I would imagine most of the kids at school were probably Christian. Or some
yes.
Jews, and
yes.
maybe some Muslims as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So how did a Buddhist kid growing up in L.A. feel about being a Buddhist?
It was, well, you know, we lived in an area where there were other Japanese Americans and Japanese American Buddhists.
Okay.
And so many of my friends, either through, like, Dharma school mm-hmm. or through youth activities or through sports, you know, came in and out of the temple.
Hmm.
The families were members and so forth.
Did the temples have sports programs?
Yes,
youth
we had scouting programs.
Okay.
We had sports. You know, we functioned not only as a temple but almost kind of as a community center.
Hmm. Okay.
And so there's a lot of cultural you know, activities, tea ceremony, you know, flower arrangement being taught and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was comfortable as long as you were in the community.
In the Japanese community?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, you know, even in the neighborhood.
Okay.
You know, because we were all accepted. You know, mm-hmm. Japanese Americans were accepted by the other ethnic
And were most students. Of the Japanese Americans Buddhist in your neighborhood?
It was probably, I don't really know, but I think okay. it was probably about half and half.
Half and half.
Because
okay.
we actually had two Japanese-American Christian churches, too. There was a Free Methodist Church and there was a Baptist Church
okay.
right in the same neighborhood
okay.
With two Buddhist temples and a couple of, like, Shinto-based, you know, religious organizations,
I
the Honkō Church and Tendikyo. Mm-hmm. And, but I would have to say, though, that, you know, admitting that I was a Buddhist, like, outside of my community mm-hmm. was something that I really didn't do.
Okay.
And I don't know if it, I don't remember if it was a conscious uh-huh. thing, but it was something that you just kind of kept to yourself.
Okay.
You didn't wear it on your lapel.
Yeah.
And I see, like, my own children, you know, 40 years later.
Yeah.
And things have changed. I think Buddhism has become much, you know, better understood, much more accepted, you mm-hmm. know, in today's society, especially in Southern California,
mm-hmm.
that they're very proud to be Buddhist, and they can, you know, announce to anybody, I am a Buddhist. And that's a very distinct difference between how I grew up.
Okay. Now, when you went to college, mm-hmm. Was there Buddhist clubs in college?
No.
There weren't any Buddhist clubs.
Yeah, Occidental, back in those days, was still pretty strongly Christian.
Okay.
And it started out as a Presbyterian college.
Oh, it did.
But by the time I entered, the formal ties with the church were cut. But they still had, you know, a very nice chapel, and they still had this requirement that every student had to take at least one semester, I think it was, of Bible studies or religion or philosophy course.
Hmm.
And so there were no Buddhist groups on campus, and if there was, probably that would have been the last group I would have joined anyway.
Yeah.
But. So, yeah, I don't remember ever even stepping into the chapel during the 4 years that I was at Occidental.
Okay. And what was the point in your life when you decided that it might be a good career decision mm-hmm. to be a Buddhist priest?
Mm-hmm.
Because it sounds like your father didn't want to pressure you.
Right.
And the cultural pressure that you would have found in Japan wasn't here in Los
right.
Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the turning point for you? When did you decide it was the right thing for you to do?
Well, if I can start a little bit
earlier.
Please. Like, I get out of high school, I
okay.
graduate from high school and accepted to Occidental. And I feel as though that's kind of like my ticket out of the community. You know, out of the Japanese American community, out of the temple.
And that would be going to college.
Going to college.
Okay.
And kind of like, you know, getting into so-called mainstream America.
Yeah.
For the first time in my life. And I remember thinking that depending on, you know, how things go, you know, depending on how my life goes from that point, I may, you know, happen to find someone who is, you know, a Christian, you know, say a Christian. And even thinking that it would be, you know, it would be easy enough for me to convert to another religion if okay. circumstances dictated.
Okay.
And so I you know, went into college with the intent of just leaving behind my background, and you know, I started out in political science actually, thinking that maybe, you know, I could become a lawyer or something.
And was that back in the 60s when
this
you were in college?
Yeah, I started in 67.
Okay, so political science was a popular
right,
subject.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And I spent a year in political science, but it was, well, you know, you're taking basically core courses anyway. But as I started to think about it, I said, you know, I just don't think that that's the direction I want to go in. So I was thinking, well, what did I do well in high school? And said, well, you know, I think a lot of Asian kids, we did well in math. So I actually switched over to math and then took my first course in, you know, first college course in math, and realized that mathematics on a college level is a completely different animal from high school. And within one semester, I was thinking, you know, I just don't have the smarts to you know, succeed in this field. So I thought, well, what takes, like, you know, similar principles, but maybe a little bit easier for me to succeed in? And I actually changed over to economics, and I was in econ for a year. But it just happened. Maybe I think, you know, we had a term system, you know, back in those days. So three terms, you know, during one academic year. And I think it was the second term that I had a free, you know, class. So I thought, well, just to try, you know, just to see what it's like, I enrolled in a class on comparative religions East and West, taught by this professor by the name of Franklin Jocelyn. He was the head of the religious studies department at the time. And I took the class without any expectations, but you know, he starts out in Hinduism, you know, starts in Asia, and then gets into Buddhism. And as he's talking about Buddhism and you know, teaching us about the Dharma, I realized, like, very quickly that I can't be anything but Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, up until that time, I was thinking I could be anything. You know, I didn't really identify myself as a Buddhist, because during my upbringing, even though I was, you know, we actually lived in the temple for a number of years, and I went to, you know, services every Sunday, participate in youth programs, so forth, but really didn't have much interest, didn't really understand, you know, other than the real simple Eightfold Path, you know, Six Paramitas type of Buddhism. And so listening to him, it was, you know, as if I was receiving the Dharma for the first time in my life. Mm. And it's, you know, it is ironic that he was a former Presbyterian minister, but who did live in Japan and who studied at Waseda University in Tokyo for a number of years, had a very keen understanding and appreciation of Buddhism. And so that it was kind of like my conversion, you know, although I was already a Buddhist, it was like converting to Buddhism for the first time in my life.
Wow.
And so I went to him after that course was completed, and I said, Dr. Ashland, I'd like to consider switching over to religious studies. And he asked me, you know, what I'd done, what courses I'd taken. He says, well, if you focus on religion, you know, your last year, then I think you can graduate. So he took me on as his student and finished out, you know, Occidental as a religious studies major. And then the other thing, and this was like from 67 through to 71, and so it was during the height of Vietnam, and all of us, you know, the male students were, well, I mean, you know, the whole campus, except for maybe the ROTC students, were anti-Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all thinking of ways that we can, you know, continue to avoid the draft after we graduate.
Yeah.
And I had friends who, you know, ran away to Canada. I had a Japanese-American friend who, on the day of his physical, in the morning, he drank a quart of shoyu, or soy sauce, to raise his, you know, blood pressure up.
Yeah.
And was given a deferment, you know. But we were all thinking of different ways of trying to get out of the draft, and the easiest was to continue with your education.
Mm.
And so I thought, well, maybe the safest thing for me is to try to get out of the country and to maybe enter a graduate school where I could, you know, continue my studies, avoid the draft, and, you know, live outside of the United States. And I had a friend who he was not at Occidental, but we were friends from high school, and he was kind of pursuing a similar course. And so we talked about it one day. He says, well, why don't we just go to Japan and see what happens? So we wrote a letter to the college of our denomination, Otani University in Kyoto, and they accepted us provisionally. They said, just come over and then you could take the entrance exams, and you know, we're pretty sure you can make it, you know. So we just bought a ticket, you know, sent a copy of our ticket to the draft board, and just left and just went to Japan. But at the time, I still wasn't thinking in terms of becoming a priest.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking more in terms of just continuing with my Buddhist studies,
okay,
and maybe going into teaching or something like that.
Okay.
And then another interesting thing that happened while I was under the guidance of Dr. Jocelyn is that he found out, you know, through our conversations that I was from a Jodo Shinshu, or Pure Land background.
Mm-hmm.
And so he encouraged me to do some of my independent studies on Pure Land.
Okay.
And this is like, you know, in the late 60s, and very few books on Pure Land Buddhism. You know, there are already quite a few, you know, D.T. Suzuki,
Yamamoto,
and so forth on Zen, and on, you know, early Buddhism.
Early Buddhism, the Vipassana,
right,
or
Theravada. Mm-hmm. Right.
But the Pure Land is oftentimes overlooked, isn't
right,
it?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so he encouraged me to do this, and so I went to the library, found some, you know, translations, sacred books of the East translations by Max Müller and others.
Yeah.
And I read the three Pure Land Sutras, and, you know, but what was really disturbing was kind of like the preface to the translation, in which I think it was, if I remember correctly, it was Max Müller who says, I've done the translations of the three Pure Land Sutras, but I'm disappointed with them, you know. Something
with,
to that.
With his translation?
No, I'm disappointed with the content of the sutras.
Ooh.
That I don't feel that they are in line with the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. But I am doing this because I have so many friends in Japan who are Pure Land Buddhists, and I know them to be very fine people, and so I'm going to, you know, I'm publishing these translations. Well, that's a kind of a, you know, it's certainly not a glowing, recommendation or anything. No. And then I read them, and I'm having trouble trying to understand and, verify that these are Buddhist texts.
Yeah.
Because my interest was Zen, okay. My interest was, in early Buddhism, mm-hmm. in Shakyamuni Buddhism. And so then it was Dr. Jocelyn who kind of helps me out, bails me out.
Okay.
And it's because he was a student of the New Theism movement, a student of Paul Tillich.
Oh, yes.
And so he, his interpretation or his understanding of God is different from the traditional view.
I see.
They use terms, as you probably know, like ground of our being or ultimate reality,
yes.
In describing or not describing, but referring to God, mm-hmm. Godhead, Godhead. Mm-hmm. And he says, maybe, you're having trouble understanding Amida or Amitabha. Maybe you can understand it in these terms.
Yeah.
And that helps me, tremendously. And so with a kind of a renewed enthusiasm, I go to Japan, enter into a master's program, and find good teachers, who are able to interpret the teachings and...
Who didn't apologize for the teachings.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Another interesting thing that happened, though, was... So my friend and I, we're in this college, graduate level. We're going through our studies. And we have some contact with the Mother Temple because my father, has let them know that we're there. So then they just kind of assume that, well, Reverend Ito's son is here studying. He must be here studying to become a priest.
Mm.
So then they just kind of, arbitrarily set up, kind of a schedule for us.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, we arrived in September, and they say, in November, we're going to have you go through the ceremony. And my Japanese was really bad.
Is that the ordination ceremony they're talking about?
Yeah, it happened, it turned out to be the ordination ceremony, but
wow.
My Japanese was so bad that I really wasn't understanding what they're saying.
Yeah.
Next thing we know, we're led into, we're at the Mother Temple, and they actually had this little barbershop right there. And I was kind of not a out-and-out hippie, but I certainly had long hair.
A child in the 60s, had longer hair, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, during college, I had hair down halfway down my back.
Okay.
And my hair was, kind of like what defined me.
Yeah.
And so they take me to the barbershop and they say, okay, we're going to shave your head. And that was a shock.
And you weren't expecting that at all.
I wasn't really, they said some, I did understand that it was some kind of ceremony, but
okay.
I really didn't know.
Yeah.
So we're ordained. And it was my friend who was a Japanese-American, third generation like me, and then a Caucasian from Chicago who was studying at the same university.
Okay.
So the three of us went through ordination together. And the good thing was it was in the cold of winter. It was like the end of November that we went through the ceremony.
Okay.
So it's so cold that, we're wearing ski caps. And so we could walk around town with our ski caps. And then right after we had the ceremony, we'd go and have lunch together. And two of us looked Japanese, one looked, was a foreigner.
Yeah.
And we'd walk into a restaurant, and then we'd be speaking English, and then we'd take our ski caps off, and all three of us are bald. And they don't know what to make of us. But anyways, those are some of the...
Well, it's interesting, because you sort of got ordained by mistake.
Almost, yeah.
Even though your whole family, generation after generation, mm-hmm. had been priests.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So now here you are with your ordination, mm-hmm. and did you decide to keep it then? Did it make
yes.
sense to you at that point?
Well, they explained it. Our tradition, the ordination, the initial ordination, is probably the simplest ceremony of all the Buddhist traditions.
Okay.
Because our founder, he happened to be ordained. He took initial ordination at the age of 9.
And who was Shin,
he? Shinran Shonin.
He was alive when?
He was from 1173 to 1262.
Okay.
So basically 12th century.
And he, just for people who have never heard of this kind of Buddhism before. He was the founder of your school of Buddhism?
Although he certainly didn't see himself as a founder.
Right.
In the same way that Chakamuni didn't see himself as a founder of a religion.
Exactly.
Or denomination or anything. But a denomination formed or was established after his death. He was actually a student of Honen Shonin.
Okay.
Who was the founder of the Jodo, or the Pure Land School of Buddhism.
Okay, and this is a different sect of Pure Land then?
Right.
It's more traditional.
Yeah.
It's more traditional.
Yeah, and then
Shingon?
It's called Jodo Shinshu.
Jodo Shinshu.
In the United States, I think the most accepted term is Shin Buddhism.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. And so he was 1100?
Yes,
okay.
1173, 1262, okay. So 12th, 13th century.
And there had already been a Pure Land sect established in Japan?
Yes, it was,
With Honen?
Yes, Honen. Honen was actually his direct teacher.
Oh,
so
okay.
The school hadn't been there for long.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was all coming out of the Tendai or the Tiantai tradition.
Yes.
The Tiantai or Tendai in Japanese was one of the two major schools after the Nara period,
okay.
Which is the initial period of Buddhism. And so Shingon is the esoteric, mm-hmm. School.
Mm-hmm.
Tendai,
a tantric kind of school.
Yes.
Okay.
And then Tendai had some of that esoteric, aspect to it. But it was a very kind of comprehensive, I think it's probably the closest to the kind of Buddhism that you would find in China.
I see.
Which would include like Lotus Sutra, Zen meditation, mm-hmm. and Pure Land.
Okay.
So it included all of that.
Okay.
And what happened in Japan is that Tendai was this, comprehensive form of Buddhism, but Dogen was a student at the Tendai Monastery, took Zen out.
Yes.
And then Nichiren was a student of Tendai and took the Lotus Sutra, out. And then Honen and Shinran were also students at the Tendai Monastery. They took the Pure Land.
Oh, I see.
And so, whereas in China it was, it was never divided into different denominations.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of, kept under one umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, it, developed into separate schools.
Separate teachings, okay. Wow, thank you for that, because it's, for me, it's confusing.
Mm-hmm. But it
seems to me, after having read the little bit that I've read, mm-hmm. that was a very important time in Japanese Buddhism.
Yes.
There was a lot of upheaval and
right.
transition going on.
Yes, that's right.
And some really remarkable people came out of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think many of the great Buddhists came out of that Kamakura period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now you're in Japan, and you've gone through this sort of simple ceremony, mm-hmm. the most simple, you said, mm-hmm. and are you thinking about now going back to the States, or do you have more studies to do in Japan?
That was like within 6 months of our arrival in Japan.
Within 6 months, you've become ordained.
But it's like initial ordination.
First ordination.
I was going to say that Shinran, there's no like definitive reason why he was ordained at such a young age.
Okay.
But one thing was that he was orphaned at an early age, and that was one of the contributing factors.
Okay.
But at age 9, he is ordained and he enters a monastery.
Yeah.
And so we have a tradition in our denomination of ordaining the first sons at the age of 9.
Okay.
And so you don't have to have studied much. You don't have to have done much. It's really the first step. It's the first you know, commitment that you make towards becoming a Buddha, a student of, Buddha, of the Buddha.
Okay.
So that's the way they explained it to me. They said, it's, you know, it, there's no responsibilities attached to...
So you didn't have to run a temple or any lead services mm-hmm. or anything.
Yeah, you can wear the simple robes, but you couldn't teach, you couldn't do anything, you know. It's just the first step.
The first step, okay.
It took me another 3 years to go to the next step.
Okay.
Well, actually to decide to go to the next step and then to, you know, actually do the full ordination.
Okay, so you during those 3 years, mm-hmm. you were still deciding if it felt right,
mm-hmm.
if it was the path you wanted to take.
Yes.
Okay, and was there a point where you said, "Yeah, this is it"? And
well, I think part of it was I was in a master's program, and I thought that in order for me to go on and teach in academia,
mm-hmm.
that I would I would have to get my doctorate.
Okay,
but I was struggling so much with just the master's that I thought, it's probably overstretching to mm-hmm. think that I could become, a teacher on say, the college level.
Yeah.
And that maybe being a priest would be the, the alternative.
Okay.
The other thing is, I don't know if you felt it, yourself, but in the United States, we have what I'm trying to say is that clergy of any kind
mm-hmm.
are looked at with higher standards.
Yes.
And so, you're kind of,
forced into being more disciplined in the way you live your life.
Yes.
Because you're a clergy.
Right.
You don't have as many options.
Right. And, I was pretty wild growing up in high school and college. And I would, kind of watch my father and see how he lived.
Yeah.
And one of the things was, when we were young, he would often take us on a vacation to Reno. I mean, not Reno, Lake Tahoe.
Lake Tahoe, okay.
And so very nice place to go.
Sure.
Daytime we could enjoy hiking and things like that. But I realized that at night he goes elsewhere. He goes to the casinos, right? And that's kind of one of the reasons why he liked Lake Tahoe as a kind of a family vacation spot.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't so much that he was really into gambling, but he liked to drink and. Just kind of, maybe just to get away from the pressures of being at the temple.
Sure.
And so on one occasion, maybe the third time we were there or something, he's in the casino and he happens to meet a person from Los Angeles, not a member of the temple, but someone that he knows, in the community.
Mm.
The man comes up to him and says, "Oh, Ito Sensei, Reverend Ito, I never thought I would see you here. I didn't think that you people enjoyed this kind of thing."
Uh-huh.
And that was a really embarrassing experience for my father.
It was.
And he never went back. The only time he would, go to Las Vegas or something is if he had a visitor from Japan that he would take. But, I watched that and I saw, the kind of the struggle that the inner struggle that he was having.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, I don't think I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that I want to, have to live according to these stringent, rules. And so that was one of the reasons, why I never thought of the priesthood as a career.
And what age were you at this point? Do you remember when you were in your master's program?
It was probably about 22, 23.
Oh, yeah. That's so young to think about living a straight and narrow life.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And so, but then, what happens is in Japan, like here in the United States, all the priests are called sensei.
Mm-hmm.
So Ito-sensei, Kusawa-sensei.
Mm-hmm.
And so that whether you're in the temple or whether you're out, walking the streets, you're always Ito sensei.
Always sensei.
So it's always kind of like you're just, what do you call it? You're not just a regular person.
That's right. That's right.
Whereas in Japan, they don't use the term sensei for priests.
Hmm.
for some reason, you know. Sensei is a title that's used for doctors and for teachers, primarily, and maybe like politicians, mm-hmm. you know, upper echelon politicians, mm-hmm. but not for priests. Mm. And so you could be walking down the street and you're just Ito-san, you know, Mr. Ito, you know. Mm-hmm. Unless you're performing, you know, a ritual, a service or something, then, of course, you know, they would use an appropriate title. Mm-hmm. And I met these wonderful, you know, people, both teachers at the college as well as priests at the Mother Temple, who kind of took me under their wings and taught me the chanting and all of these things. And we'd go out and they were able to, like, kind of, like, separate, you know, their professional life from their personal life. Nice. To be, and you know, in our tradition, our Jodo Shinshu tradition allows us to do that,
sure.
you know, to get married and have family and so sure. forth. And so I thought, well, if they could do it, then maybe I could do it also.
Okay.
And so it was meeting these people, these great teachers in Japan, that gave me the kind of the confidence.
And they allowed you to see how to do it.
Right.
You couldn't figure quite out how to live both kinds of lives at the same
right.
time.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even really like a conscious, you know, effort to separate between your career,
yeah.
or, you know, your profession as a priest and
yeah.
your everyday life.
Yeah.
But that they just really were able to be themselves.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, if I was, you know, I came to Buddhism late in life. I was 30, mm-hmm. 28, 30 when I found out about Buddhism, and I was in my 40s when I got ordained. So, mm-hmm. so if I had been in my early 20s, I don't think I would have even thought of it as mm-hmm. an option,
mm-hmm.
because in my 20s I was sort of wild and having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older, I saw that it was pretty empty stuff mm-hmm. and didn't really matter that much. So now you have your first ordination mm-hmm. and you've got your master's degree. You're not quite sure whether you want to go to PhD. You decided, mm-hmm. well, maybe I'll be a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And you figured out how to live in the world and live at the temple at the same time.
Right.
Because these people took you under the wing.
Right.
So at that point, did you come back to America? Or did
yes.
you did? Okay.
I finished my master's. I finished the you know, training
mm-hmm.
For the priesthood
mm-hmm.
and got my full ordination.
Okay.
And then I guess I communicated with the temple and said you know, I would consider accepting a position as a you know, priest at the temple.
Yeah.
And I think I was probably the first priest at any of our temples who was a native English speaker.
Okay.
And so just that alone was enough, you know, to, you know.
To make you a good
yeah,
candidate?
Right.
You had a
yeah.
skill
right.
that was necessary
yeah.
or useful.
Yeah. yeah. Although I wasn't anywhere near ready.
Yeah. Well, now this is an interesting point, too, mm-hmm. because a lot of people think, well, once you become ordained,
mm-hmm.
It's all done.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, mm-hmm. in my own case and the other people I've talked to, mm-hmm. it's not all done, it's just the beginning.
Right.
And
exactly.
so now you needed to learn mm-hmm. the workings of the temple.
Right.
So when you were hired as the priest of the mm-hmm. temple, did you start off at the bottom and then
yes.
you had to sort of work
right.
your way up?
Yeah. At the time, we had already three priests, including
okay.
my father.
Okay.
So I had two older, you know, two what we call senpai, you know, mentors.
Okay, so they had seniority.
Right. And so I was at the bottom of the totem pole.
Okay.
And, you know,
yeah.
It took me maybe a good 5 years to get comfortable.
Okay.
To feel as though I was contributing.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully people listening to this will see that if they've read a book on Buddhism and have decided that they want to be a Buddhist clergy, it surely doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
There's the education part, there's the practice part, and then there's the training part that goes on forever.
Right. That's right.
So, as you were the priest at the temple, then did you marry your wife from the temple? Did you meet her here? Or
well, actually, she was a member of another temple.
Another temple, okay.
Yeah, but we had an active youth program,
uh-huh.
high school, basically high school kids.
Mm.
And the temples in Southern California, they would, you know, they had this, well, we still have a, like a league, association. So we'd have all these activities, seminars and sometimes social activities, retreats, you know, conferences, things like that. And my wife happened to be the advisor of the youth group at the West LA Temple, near UCLA.
Okay.
Because she actually grew up in Gilroy, California, which is near San Jose.
Yep, I know where that is.
The garlic capital.
The garlic capital, that's right.
Right, so she grew up there, but she went to UCLA. Okay. And after she graduated, she decided to stay, found a job, and found the temple and started, you know, becoming active and eventually became the advisor. Mm. And a priest at the Nishōngwanji Temple, we were in Japan together, got to be friends, and so we were like the respective advisors for our, the advisors for our respective chapters. And we would go to these events together. And he knew Janet from, because he was from San Francisco, and so, you know, the districts were closer. So he knew Janet, even though she was a lot younger. So he introduced me to her. And, you know, the interesting thing is, like, she, you know, we all wear, like, name tags.
Yes.
And so they misspelled her last name. Mm-hmm. And her last name was Sakai, S-A-K-A-I. But they spelled it S-E-K-A-I. And I've never seen a last name, you know, that's written S-E-K-A-I, because S-E-K-A-I in Japanese means world, or like Mother Earth, you know. And so I looked at the name tag and I said, gee, that's a, you know, I've never seen that name before. And it just kind of stuck in my mind. I don't know, maybe her, you know, her other features stuck in my mind as well, but the name certainly did.
Sure.
Then I found out, you know, after I saw her the next time, that it was a misspelling, and she had a more ordinary last name. But that's how we met.
And is in the culture, is marrying a priest a good thing to do? So you look at that as, you know, sometimes people say marrying politicians is good, or marrying lawyers and doctors is good. Is marrying a priest considered to be a good
I think that,
marriage move?
Yeah, for the regular member, you know, who's not like, you know, involved, you know, in maintaining the temple, like on the board of directors or something, who doesn't know all the ins and outs, would consider it to be a good thing.
Okay.
But those who are like close and who, you know of the struggles, you know,
how much work
yeah,
it is.
And how much sacrifice, you know, the ministers make and so forth.
Sure.
Probably steer their children away. one of the things, I guess, as far as her parents were concerned, is, you know, and you see this in your communities too, but, you know, a lot of marrying out of, you know, your ethnic community.
Yeah.
And so my wife was the third child of four. And her older brother and her older sister had already married outside, you know, outside of the community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And her younger brother was getting set to marry, you know, a Caucasian also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when Janet went to her parents and said, I'm thinking of marrying, you know, Norihito, they were, you know, basically overjoyed because I was a Japanese-American.
Sure.
The interesting thing, though, was her grandmother on her father's side, her both grandparents were devout Seventh-day Adventists.
Wow.
And they were Seventh-day Adventists from Japan. In Japan, they came over, you know, and continued, you know, in their faith. And so Janet takes me to meet her grandmother, and she sees me and says, oh, and she's so happy. And says, oh, you know, you're marrying, you know, someone from our community. Very overjoyed. But so then we have the wedding, and, you know, of course, her grandmother's there. And she sees me coming out in my Buddhist robe, because I was already a priest. And you know, that was a big shock to her.
Was there a little bit of tension there?
A little bit, but then what happened was she accepted our marriage very graciously.
Oh, wonderful.
And then every time that we went to see her, you know, the other thing that she enjoyed was the fact that I could speak Japanese, because none of her children, her grandchildren could speak Japanese, and none of their spouses could speak Japanese. So here, you know, I come along and I could speak to her in Japanese. So she liked that about me. she wasn't real happy about the Buddhist part. And so every time we'd meet and have some time for conversation, she would bring out her books and her pamphlets.
Of her religion?
Yeah. And so she would try to, make me see, the value of her tradition.
Yeah.
And so actually, in a sense, it was my first interreligious dialogue.
Okay. Yes. Well, now to jump ahead a little bit, mm-hmm. you are the director of the Buddhist Club mm-hmm. at Occidental.
Yes.
And so when you went there, they didn't have one. Has there been one there for a while?
Yes. Well, I was the... I came along and started the first group.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and okay. So this was back in 1987 or so. So
it's was there any resistance from the university?
No, not at all.
Not at all. Okay.
There was a man by the name of Doug Gray, who was a Congregationalist Christian, mm-hmm. who was the head of the department or head of the religious life.
Okay.
And they already had a Newman group, Catholic group, Hillel, Jewish group, mm-hmm. Maybe three Christian groups. Hmm. They even had Latter-day Saints
okay.
and Christian Science
okay.
was already there too. And I happened to have known the person who was the Catholic advisor.
I see.
Through a community. And so she knew that I was an alum, and so she called me up and said, I think we've been looking at our student list, and we see there's an increasing number of Asian students, many of who put Buddhism as their background religion. Mm-hmm. And so we think that it's time to start a Buddhist group, and so would you be interested? Mm-hmm. And so I jumped at the opportunity, and I went and then got the list from them. And it was maybe, 30 or 40 Asian students, some of who were Japanese American, and who I imagine probably went through the Young Buddhist Association, the youth groups at our temples. Mm-hmm. So I sent notices to all of them and said, we're going to look into starting up a group, and so please come. And I think the first notice I sent out, I only got like one or two students that came. Mm. And there just wasn't much interest.
Yeah.
And but then they supplied me with another list, and it was students who were non-Asian, mm-hmm. but who had an interest in Buddhism or in meditation. So I sent out notices to them, and they came. And so basically, over almost 20 years of being, the advisor there, I probably had, I can probably count the number of Asians that have been, part of the group.
Okay.
It's primarily been a non-Asian group.
And so it leads me to believe that in the West, mm-hmm. there's a real strong interest
yes.
in Buddhism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And meditation, I guess, in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think it's important to have a Buddhist presence on campus?
I definitely think so.
Okay.
And when I first started out in 87,
okay.
The Buddhist group was the smallest group, of all the faith groups that were on campus by far.
Yeah.
We only had maybe five or six. And there were weeks when I'd go and nobody would show up. But eventually, as time passed, the group, start to get larger, more active, and students would stay with me the whole 4 years that they were there, and really become totally, truly Buddhist
yeah.
within 2 years.
Wow.
And start living a Buddhist lifestyle that surpassed my own, so-called Buddhist lifestyle
yeah.
in many ways. And about maybe 2 years ago, I looked at the list of all the faith groups on campus,
uh-huh.
and the Buddhist group, at least the in numbers,
yeah.
we were like the number two group.
Wow!
Next to the Catholic group.
Wow!
And so we've grown from our humble beginnings,
yeah.
and it's amazing. I mean, we'd have maybe like at the start of the year, we'd have like 40 students on the list. On a campus of 1,600 students, so it's had its impact. on Occidental.
Well, and that I can segue into this then, maybe from that too, because I've spoken at your temple a couple times, and I've always enjoyed it. And when I come here, I've noticed that there were a lot of Japanese and a lot of older Japanese, but also younger Americans, Westerners, here too, learning about Buddhism. If somebody's listening to this and feels a desire to go to a Buddhist temple, do you think they should be anxious about that? When somebody comes here for the first time, say a Westerner comes, and you know they don't know anything about the protocol, do you make them feel comfortable? Do you give them information? Do you what the schedule is?
We try, we try to the best of our abilities to welcome new people, guests to the temple. And we have a service book, in the pews that explains the service, the format, the symbolism behind, the things that we do, what is incense offering for and so forth.
Okay.
And so that if they just read a few of those pages, then, they would at least know what's going on and why.
And so they wouldn't really even need to ask a whole lot of questions if they just looked at that book.
Right.
They would.
Yes.
Okay.
And then we've been trying to do more kind of like discussion, informal, instead of like, the priest standing up there and, kind of like preaching in quotes, just making it much more interactive and, to maybe, sit in the hondo, in the main sanctuary, and I would talk, but would invite questions or, discussion.
Okay.
Or when we have a smaller group, we would even come in here and just have a discussion.
And just sit around a table and ask questions and things. So it would take a little bit of courage, but once the process started, it would feel familiar pretty quickly. And everybody I've met here has been so courteous and gracious, and I feel like an old friend every time I come to visit, so it's wonderful.
Yeah, it was interesting. About maybe 3 months ago, we had some students from Loyola Marymount.
Oh, yeah.
And, I guess they were writing a report or something, and they came. And so I had a chance to talk with them and, answer some questions after the gathering was over. And they were both raised Catholic, and, they grew up going to church. And they said, that being here, it felt so comfortable because it reminded them of their childhood.
Yeah.
I guess the altar kind of looks, it's ornate in the same way that a Catholic church is.
Sure.
And we have the chanting it's completely different. But anyways, they felt very comfortable here.
Wonderful. And speaking about the Catholics and the Buddhists, now the Los Angeles Buddhist Catholic Dialogue has been going on since 1989, and you've been a member for a while. When did you become interested in the Buddhist Catholic Dialogue?
I think it was through the encouragement of two people.
Okay.
One was Michael Kersey, who was the director at Occidental College of Religious Life for a number of years.
Okay.
And who I, learned so much from. And then the other was Reverend Mascudani, who was my, mentor at Senshin.
Yes.
And the two of them were active. And
okay.
So, yeah. But I have to admit that I haven't been a very good member over the last few years. But I have the next meeting on my calendar.
Well, it's hard to go to every meeting, that's for sure, because they actually happen every month.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my schedule, and I'm sure your schedule sometimes doesn't permit you to attend. But for somebody listening to this who's never thought about Catholics and Buddhists coming together, after being a part of it, do you think it's a good thing? Do you think it helps to understand the other?
I think it's a wonderful thing.
Okay.
I've learned so much from the experience myself. And I think that because it's a group that has been in existence for a long time, people can be quite frank with each other.
Yeah.
And so it's, I'm involved in a number of other circles where when you don't know each other well enough, you tend to be too cautious.
Yes.
And so you don't ask the penetrating questions or so that it's just kind of superficial. It's just people coming together, you know, saying good things about each other and saying goodbye. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Buddhist Catholic dialogue, I think, it has a lot more substance, and it really is a dialogue, a meaningful dialogue.
Yeah. One of the things that I learned from you at one of the Buddhist Catholic dialogues we attended was the fact that every year you take students to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. When I look at the news today and read the newspapers and go online, I see everybody wants nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And we're both from the 60s.
Yes.
And there was a whole different understanding about nuclear weapons in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And that seems to have changed for some reason. Could you just talk a little bit about why you decided to do that? What was your inspiration to take students to Japan and see those two places? And then what is their reaction? What do you see and what is their reaction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been leading the youth group to Japan for maybe about 10 years now, over 10 years, I think. In the first few years, it wasn't that we avoided those places, but we just went to other historical areas, more that have significance to our teaching or to our, you know, history.
Like ancient Buddhist temples?
Yes.
Okay.
Areas where the founder lived and where temples were established and so forth.
Okay.
But 1 year I thought that it would be a great experience to take the kids to Hiroshima.
And had you been there before?
I had been there. I was there as a student.
Okay.
So it had been many, many years, you know, since I had the chance to revisit.
Okay.
And, well, one of the interesting things about what happened in my life with regard to Hiroshima was when I decided to, you know, go to Japan to study back in 71, I had the chance to stop. You know, back in those days, they had flights that stopped in Hawaii and then went to Japan.
Mm.
So I stopped in Hawaii and stayed there for a few days, and I went to the Pearl Harbor Memorial for the first time in my life. And I was there and paying my respects. And although I totally identified myself as an American, I also acknowledge the fact that I was born in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, my long-term history was Japan, so that I had to identify myself at least to a small part as a Japanese. And, you know, being at Pearl Harbor and thinking to myself, how could, you know, the people of Japan, you know, my country, have done this to Americans or to people?
Yeah.
Feeling this tremendous guilt, you know, at the same time.
It must have been a really interesting dichotomy for you,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, American Japanese, mm-hmm. Japanese coming over attacking America,
mm-hmm.
and your allegiance lies mm-hmm. in both places.
Right. I mean, and I'm sure that that's exactly what happened with the Japanese that were living in Hawaii and on the West Coast, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe to a certain extent, that's what kind of like enabled them to go quietly into the camps.
I see.
Because there was this kind of underlying guilt, you know, of being Japanese, and, you know, how could our people have done something like that?
Just to, and this is a digression, so people listening, excuse me for digressing, but did Buddhism go to the camps? Did they have Buddhist service mm-hmm. in the camps?
Not at first.
Not at first.
In fact, you know, what happened was when the FBI came, started rounding up all of the Japanese,
mm-hmm.
The first people that they arrested and took away were the leaders of the Japanese-American communities.
And that included clergy?
It included Buddhist priests and included, like, Japanese language teachers,
mm-hmm.
The heads of, you know, the different organizations and so forth. But the Buddhist priests were among the first locked up and taken away. And they were taken away to these camps that, people don't really talk about because they're so small. But they were, like, the most dangerous, considered to be the most dangerous people from the American government point of view. Mm-hmm. And they weren't released into the you know, regular camps for maybe over a year. So although there are many, you know, Buddhists who were relocated to Manzanar and to Jerome and, you know, to the big camps, mm-hmm. The clergy weren't available because they were all locked up somewhere in, you know, almost like a, you know, maybe not maximum security, but almost like in prison-like conditions.
Wow.
Until, you know, the threat was over. I mean, you know, almost kind of like Guantanamo in
yeah.
a sense. Yeah,
that's what it sounds
when
like.
Think about. But so that the Christian clergy were there in the camps, uh-huh. and they were holding services, but the Buddhists, there were very few Buddhist priests who were available in any of the camps. And finally they were released, and, you know, they were given the permission to hold services and so forth,
okay.
so that religious, you know, services according to Buddhist tradition were, you know, maybe in the from the second year on, allowed in the camps.
Mm, that's fascinating. I had no idea. That's interesting. So
we just did. We have a group called the Nikkei Interfaith Fellowship.
Okay.
And we just did. We just put together a book. In fact, I'll give you a copy.
Oh, thank you.
It's more like a pamphlet.
Okay.
But stories of internment, stories of Buddhists and Christians working together, and so forth.
And where we're sitting right now, your temple's on 3rd Street,
yes.
which is, I guess, in Little Tokyo, or pretty close. And isn't there a new museum that
yes.
just opened up relatively recently
yes.
that documents
yes.
the plight of the mm-hmm. people who were incarcerated?
Yeah, the Japanese-American National Museum.
Okay.
They call it JANM.
Okay.
And they're right on the corner of 1st and Central.
Uh-huh.
And their first exhibit space was actually the old Nishi Honganji temple, which the city originally condemned, but I guess they were able to retrofit it so that it's usable now.
Oh, good, good.
But they also built a bigger second wing.
I see.
And have both permanent as well as, what do you call it, permanent exhibits as well as traveling exhibits.
Traveling exhibits, okay. Well, now let's go back to Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
and you're faced with this sort of dilemma.
Right.
You have allegiance to America, mm-hmm. you have allegiance to Japan, mm-hmm. and you're looking at the memorial,
mm-hmm.
and you must have, you know, twisted or pulled on your heart
yes.
in a very interesting
right.
way.
And I go to Japan, and,
uh-huh.
you know, student there, living there, and a couple of years later, I had a chance to visit Hiroshima.
Yeah.
And it was almost like the same experience, but it was
opposite,
the opposite.
Yeah.
yeah. And so I'm going through the memorial,
mm-hmm.
and you know the museum,
mm-hmm.
where they have all the, you know, the artifacts and the photos, the terrible photos and so forth, and feeling this tremendous guilt because now I'm identifying myself as an American. And it's kind
yeah.
of like, you know,
yeah.
I mean, and it's kind of like the karma of the Japanese American.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
that's what we have to live with.
Yeah,
but it's such a moving experience that you go through it, and you know you just can't help but, like, you know, have this. I mean, you know, well, have a commitment to do something. You know, I know that I can't change the world, but
mm-hmm.
you know, in my small way, to do something, at least to tell the stories.
Yeah.
To make people understand how terrible, you know, nuclear arms are.
Mm-hmm. So you had started taking the students over
mm-hmm.
to Japan,
right.
and in the second or third year, mm-hmm. you decided, well, let's go
yeah.
to
mm-hmm.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki
right.
and introduce the students mm-hmm. to this history, this
mm-hmm.
part of history.
Right.
And what was their take on that? Because if they were young,
mm-hmm.
they probably... Even like Chernobyl
mm-hmm.
wasn't
mm-hmm.
in the reality, because
mm-hmm.
I think that's the 70s or 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So what was their impression when they saw the devastation
mm-hmm.
and the absurdity
mm-hmm.
of nuclear weapons?
Yeah, I think that, of course, you know, all the kids have, you know, learned history.
Yeah.
And so they knew that, you know, World War II happened and that the atomic bombs were dropped and so forth. They knew that, you know, intellectually.
Yeah.
But to go through and to actually see, you know, the suffering, the photographs, and these artifacts that were found, that, you know, twisted pieces of metal, that you just, you know, unimaginable, you know, the heat that must have been generated to you know, or these iron doors that were just, you know, blasted off. And then also, I think one of the most moving things is seeing the videos of survivors who talked, you know, in their own, using their own words, of the horrific conditions that they had to endure, and they also have these drawings. I guess it was a therapeutic, you know, to get these survivors to draw what they remember, and just, I mean, it depicts horrors that, you know, are just unimaginable.
Yeah. And is there a room with bones or something, some kind of?
Yes. Well, that was in Nagasaki.
That was in Nagasaki.
Yeah, I took a group of students to Nagasaki, and we didn't have a place to stay, and we're on a limited budget, and so we got permission to stay at our temple in Nagasaki, only maybe a mile away from the station, and it's a small temple, but they have a courtyard in front, you know, kind of a garden. And they have this big monument. It's about a 10-foot monument. Mm. And inscribed are four Chinese characters. Hisen, Hikaku Hisen. And translated, you know, into English, it would mean no nukes, no war. Hikaku Hisen, yeah, so no nukes, no war. The priest came, you know, came out and explained the monument to us, and he what he wanted to emphasize is it doesn't say Hansen, the word for like anti-war, like anti-war movements and so forth is Hansen, it doesn't say Hansen, it says Hisen, no war, not anti-war, and the reason why is because when you say anti, then you're on one side, and you're protesting against other people, you know, people who disagree with you. You know, so in this case, you know, those who favor nuclear arms or who advocate for war, you're just putting yourself, you know, on the other side and just kind of criticizing, you know, from a kind of a lofty position. But he says, when you say no nukes, no war, you're telling yourself. You know, it's not addressed to others, it's addressed to yourself.
That's fascinating.
And then there's this little pathway that leads down from the courtyard, goes down into kind of an alley area, and there, right underneath this 10-foot monument, is a vault, and it's got like metal doors. And so after he explained the monument to us, he took us down, opened the vault. And I guess, you know, he had already prepared for our visit. And so he had, inside there's about maybe 10 iron, it's like foot lockers.
Okay.
With, you know, doors, you know, that open up like this. And so he had one open already. And he said, in this vault contains the remains, the cremains of some 10 to 20,000 people.
Who died because of the bomb?
Yes, at Nagasaki. Wow. And so he had one of them open, and he, you know, and there was a skull sitting there, and some other bones. Most of it's ash, but you know, some bones sitting there. And he tells our kids, he says, "Well, I'm sure that you've seen, you know, bones, you know, human bones before, but you can tell, you know, by looking, you see that the color is different. It's a lot darker."
That's because of the radiation?
Yes, right.
Wow.
And, you know, and it was interesting because we spent 3 days in Kyoto going through a retreat, and then we visited one other place before going to Nagasaki. And every time that we would enter a temple or, you know, sit for a service, I would have to remind the kids to put their hands together in Gassho. And you know, and so they'd just be sitting there, and say, "Okay, everyone, Gassho," and then they'd all do it. Well, when we went to that vault, and he opened the doors for us, all of the kids just, you know, naturally and automatically put their hands together and bowed,
paying respect.
Yeah. And my son happened to be on that particular tour. And right after that, we went to the museum, went through, you know, the you know, the exhibits there. And that evening, we were having dinner, and my son says to me, you know, today was a life-changing day for me. And I couldn't, you know, I had absolutely no appetite. Yeah, and even now, you know, basically I've lost my appetite, and I just can't help, you know, but think about what happened, 55 years ago. Yeah. And another thing was, we were going through the museum, and I guess the priest, when he was explaining the monument, he said, we didn't put this up to criticize the United States or to say who was right or wrong. You know, this is just to say that, you know, this is an example of the cruelty that human beings can inflict upon each other.
Yeah.
And it's not to, you know, choose sides or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we go to the museum, and we're going through the exhibits, and one of the older kids, he was a college student already, comes up to me and he says, Sensei, why is it wrong for us to hate the Americans who did this? You know, because he was just filled with hate,
yeah,
even though he's an American himself. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, he was filled with hate for those who made those decisions.
Sure.
But I told him, I said, well, it's not, you know, it really is an example of, you know, how cruel we can be to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to say that, you know, therefore these people are right. You know, and the Japanese, whether it's Hiroshima or Nagasaki, they're very careful. They'll point out all of the facts. You know, one of the things that I really appreciate is how they point out how many nuclear arms, you know, like say the United States has. You know, they have this one that's really, it's like this, it's a video, you know, that they show. And they'll say the first one was built here and then the second one here. And then Russia came along, and then France came along, and, you know, and so they point out all of the nuclear weapons that have been built that still exist,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, how dangerous that is.
Yeah.
But we just really don't think about it unless it's pointed out to us like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, now we have Pakistan and
right.
India.
Yeah, yeah.
And Iran mm-hmm. seems to want to have one. I don't
that's
know if
right.
that's the truth
yeah.
or not, but... Mm-hmm. But everybody seems to want one,
mm-hmm.
and I think we've forgotten mm-hmm. What they're used for,
right?
And what happens when we do mm-hmm. use them. And mm-hmm. As far as I can tell, when it comes to war, there aren't any winners.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's a loser.
Yeah. Yeah, so I really wish that you know, the leaders of all of the countries,
yeah.
President Bush, you know, first of all, but you mm-hmm. know, all of them could go maybe together.
Yeah.
You know? And go through both Hiroshima and Nagasaki,
yeah.
and see, you know, just experience for themselves,
yeah.
you know, the stories that are continuing to be told.
Mm. And like you said a few minutes ago, you said, well, there's not much I can do
mm-hmm.
Myself. Mm-hmm. I'm just one person. But like the inscription mm-hmm. on the monument says, no war. Mm-hmm. So what we can do, I suppose, mm-hmm. is tell ourselves.
That's right.
No war.
Yeah, that's right.
And no nukes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess that's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you very much for this interview, because it's special to me that you were able to take time out of your busy schedule and sit down with me and talk. And I'm sure people listening are going to be taken by what you had to say and how you said it. And hopefully if anybody's interested in... learning more about Buddhism, they'll feel less anxious about that now and realize that Buddhist temples are places where everybody comes. I want to say this correctly. Buddhists seem to be everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
That there's no stereotype of what a Buddhist is.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddhist temples are open to everybody who's interested in Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And do you have a website?
Yes.
And could you give us the address of your
yes.
website?
It's www.hhbt-la.org.
Uh-huh.
And the HHBT stands for Higashi Honganji Buddhist Temple, and LA is Los Angeles.
And if they go to the website, will they be able to find the schedule of the temple here?
Yes.
And the events that are occurring?
Yes.
And would they, would you feel comfortable in saying, come on by, if they're
yes.
so, if they so desire?
With no reservation.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. Well, thank you again.
And you.
I hope our paths cross soon so we
yes.
can have another discussion.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Well, that's it. That was my interview with Reverend Nori Ito, a Buddhist priest at a Pure Land Temple in downtown Los Angeles. Hope you found it interesting. Hope you found it useful. If you'd like more information on his temple, please visit their website, www.hhbt-la. That's Harold Boy Tom-la.org. If you'd like more information on me, please visit my website, kusala.info, kusala.info. If you'd like to listen to some of the past podcasts and see a couple videos I have posted on the internet, please visit my webpage, dharmatalks.info. That's dharmatalks.info. And if you'd like to email me, my email address is kusala@urbandharma.org. Well, until the next time, until the next podcast, be happy, be peaceful, and most of all, be free from suffering.